Hello and welcome to Enemies of Good Art on Resonance FM. I should say Resonance 104.4 FM. Today I'm joined by three women, Toyn, Marcia and Angie. And it's a slightly different show for us today. We're going to talk about domestic violence and women who have come through it. I met Toyn at the South Bank Centre before Christmas, and I was so moved by the way she talked about her experiences in front of a group of women, a large group of women that she had never met before, and talked about domestic violence and how it had affected her life and how she has come through the other side. And so we met sometime afterwards, and shortly afterwards actually, and talked about how women are affected by the issues involved and how they're supported and how they support each other. So I'm wondering if we could start with you, Toyn, and you could talk about why you're here.
Well, I'm here to sort of talk at some lesser degree, hopefully, about my private experience, but make shed light on the broader experience, because other women here as well and other women listening, of domestic violence and how wide that term is, and how you don't have to wait till you're broken up physically, that actually violence comes in all shapes and sizes, all forms, and it's extremely has long lasting effects, debilitating effects, no matter what the background, your background is, no matter what your level of education is, culturally, socially, economically, it happens to at least one in four women. That's the recorded statistic. However, I suspect it happens a lot more. It's much more prevalent than that. Mm. And I suppose the effect it had on my life, I mean, I was a professional woman working as a broadcaster, reporter, and I had my own flat and everything. But the experience actually reduced me to a speechless, a shadow of who I am, who I've become today, and who I was before, practically non-existent. And I think people need to hear more from other women, if they can speak, of the experience and how it can affect anybody. And it still does in their private homes. And people don't acknowledge it because it's not your textbook case, or you haven't been hurt enough, or because you want to look after your children. You want the best for your children, so there, and you can't afford the best. Therefore, you'll put up with anything. And also, to a certain extent, also reflects on what marriage in society, what people see marriage is, what is acceptable behind the doors and what's acceptable public. You know, they're two different things going on.
And from our conversation, you talked about other women who had come through the process with you,
yeah,
and other women that you had met. And so, which is why we're joined by Angie and Marcia. And I should also say that we're all mothers around the table today. Perhaps, Marcia, you could say why you're interested in this discussion publicly.
I personally am interested simply because when you hear about domestic violence, you assume a woman behind closed doors is being beaten up.
Mm.
From my personal experience, the fists or the slaps or the kicks didn't come, but it was the mental and the financial torture. The mentor was controlling me and keeping the distance between myself and my children apart, but also the financial constraints to avoid me from leaving home, being able to support my children, was making me financially responsible for the home. Not paying bills, I had to pay that. Not paying the mortgage, I had to pay that. Not paying the children's school fees, I had to pay that. Not doing the shopping, I had to pay that. So each month, once I got paid from my legal job, I was left broke. I couldn't even afford to give my children 10 pence to go to the local shop and buy a 10 pence bag of sweets.
Mm.
So it's recognising the fact that, yes, domestic violence is there, but it comes in many forms, not just the fist, the push, the foot, the mental, the emotional, the financial.
And Angie?
Everybody is. I used to think domestic violence also is a physical thing. But like yourself, Marcia, I have experienced psychological side of it. And it wasn't that I could prove to people that I was suffering, because if I was bruised or something, I could show the GP or professionals that I was really experiencing domestic violence. But mine was psychological as well as financial. And I got to a stage that I did not want to leave. Things got so bad, but I had responsibility of 3 children, one who was disabled and 2 younger one, which I had to keep on living in it, not being able to get out of it, because I have experienced it twice in my life. The first one, I had just a baby I could grab and run away. I started my life all over again. But second time round, I had 3, and I could not go through all that stage of being homeless and drag them along with me. And plus, my first child was disabled, and it made my life even more difficult. And I want to be able to reach someone who is in the same boat as I used to be, that they can look for help if so they can reach out, basically, not to stay where they are and suffer in silence, because that's what's happened with me, 15 years of silence, suffering in silence. And I want to say there is always, now I learned there is a way out of it.
Right. And it's knowing that way out, or taking that first step, that's the big thing. And that must have been a big thing for all of you. So how did it work for you, Marcia? How did you make how did you escape?
I was fortunate. I have 3 older children that I brought into my marriage, and we also had been, this was our second time around experiencing domestic violence, so we saw the signs. Although they were very subtle, it took us a good many years to realise they were there, but my children actually recognised the signs before I did, all about the control in the home, whether or not the children could come and give me a hug or talk to me. And they started making plans. They sat me down and basically said, we cannot sit back and watch you go through this anymore, and it's not fair on our younger siblings. So it was a whole year in planning, sneaking away with the passports, the birth certificates, my 19-year-old son at the time of 17 opened up a secret bank account so we could squirrel money away. And we started making the phone calls. And one of the good things was, which worked in my benefit, some people cried, I smiled when I got made redundant. I had time at home whilst my husband was at work to go through Women's Aid website, which was extremely good, and I recommend it if you're not sure if you are. There's tick boxes that will help you work out whether or not you are experiencing domestic violence, but it also helps you to get rid of the cookies. Anyway, we went through that. Yes, I'm definitely going through the domestic violence route again, and my older children took charge of my younger kids in helping us get them away, as well as the passport. So my husband knew something was going on, wasn't quite sure, but I was the innocent party because I wasn't actually doing it myself. Mm-hmm. And my older kids got us out the home with the paperwork we needed, and I was able to get away, go to a friend's house, make the phone call, and move into a woman's refuge.
Well, I picked up a leaflet at my GP's office and I hid it. And it took a very long time. It was a crisis moment, and I thought, right, I better phone. And I remember the phone call, and I phoned, and that started a series of things happening. I got a support worker, but I was still in my own home. It's really important to know that you can actually get support in and stay in a relationship. You don't have to move out, but if you need the support, you can still get it. So I had a support worker, unbeknown to my husband, but actually at one point when it hit a crisis, I actually said, I have a support worker, I have somebody, because one of the things is, of course, being isolated. But that actually at that point made no difference, because that was just talk for me. He didn't even hear that, really. It just made absolutely no difference. But I did have somebody. So it took a year before I actually then physically moved, and that was because I was in and out of hospital, not because I was being physically beaten up, because I was actually quite ill at the time, and I was pregnant. And I had some medical issues, but the psychological pressure and the emotional abuse and the financial abuse were so great that I wondered if I'd make it through, and if I'd survive, live through this treatment. And I remember thinking, what would happen to my 2 children? And they were, one was 4, and I was 6. And that's when I thought, right, I do have to go. So with my support worker, we planned everything, and I was going to leave. But what happened just before then, just the weekend before I was meant to leave, he started changing his pattern and wanted to take my children, the children out. And I thought, no, because I had a feeling things would go wrong at the very last minute. So on the Sunday, that weekend before I was meant to leave, I called the police. And they came in, and because a lot of anger, emotion, and shouting. There's a lot of anger, mismanagement, you know, unbridled anger in the house. And called the police, and we left on that day with a bag, and that was it. That was it. Simple as that. That's how I finally left.
That was fear.
But that was just the beginning. That was just the beginning of a journey that I didn't know how hard it would be. But I thank God I took that step.
Well, if you hadn't called the police that day, do you think you would have left then, or would it have just... Is that a fair question, even?
I would have left. I was already planning on leaving, but I think that he... I just felt, maybe it was just my state of mind, but I felt that he was going to do something at the last minute and take the children away, take them out of the house, so therefore it would stop us leaving. I had this feeling that things were going to go wrong. It might have been totally in my mind, because at that point I was so emotionally broken down that I couldn't really tell what was what. I just thought, I've got to get out of here today. I can't wait till tomorrow, just in case he takes them away and I have to leave on my own. I can't leave on my own. But it might have been totally in my mind. I have no idea. Because at that point, I didn't know anything. I just did not know head to toe. I just wanted to get out.
Did you, Angie, not being from this country, being Iranian, did you find it difficult to access support? Indeed, in order to get out of the situation, did you know where to go? Or did you find it... Nobody knows where to go initially, but did you find it an easy process?
No, I didn't. First of all, I was mostly controlled not only by my partner, but by my in-laws as well, my own families and in-laws, because of the certain belief of the cultural belief and cultural way of living within your marriage, and lots of things were not acceptable. It's to them, it was like you made your bed and you sleep in it. It's marriage comes with its difficulty, and you have to live through it, and all of us experience it. And it was hard for them to believe that I was suffering and I was experiencing abuse, and it made it even difficult for me to know there was a help out there. But it was when I coming from different culture, living in this country, was another difficulty for me, because I knew what I was experiencing was not right and I shouldn't be living that way. Yet it was I was made to feel this is the way. Accessing help outside was very difficult, because when you are controlled, you're out, you weren't allowed to go out, or if you did go out, you were followed. It was really, really hard, until I was talking to a friend who brought it to my attention. This is abuse you're experiencing, and there are help out there. And
that's okay. So eventually you did manage to. What's really wonderful, and what's brought you three together today in particular, is the work that you now do in terms of supporting other women. And when we met and we talked about what we might talk about today, you mentioned, Marcia, you mentioned in particular that the support from other women that you've received since has been quite incredible and encouraging.
Yeah, because a lot of the times once you've fled the home, the domestic violence, you will go through sheltered housing, say a woman's refuge or a hostel or temporary accommodation, and 9 times out of 10, it's very rare that you stay within the borough you come from. You're removed out of the borough. So you now find yourself not only having fled domestic violence, you're actually isolated, because you might have left family and friends back in that borough. You're now totally on your own. You can go through the woman's refuge and make friends and have a laugh and a giggle, and they will hold you, and you cry, and you've got your support worker. But once you move from that environment into a hostel or into temporary accommodation, you are on your own with your family. And, you know, we have the support. You have what we call floating support. Once you move into that, like we did with Westside, once they recognised that we were coming through the other end, they put it together that maybe we would like to join their training programme to become peer support mentors in order to help other women who have either just left or going through and trying to come out the other end. Because I must admit, I love working with these guys, and every meeting is a giggle session. Everything is serious, but we're so happy that, you know, we have come through and we can smile and laugh and enjoy life again. And we want to pass that on to those that need it.
Yes, there is a camaraderie between, because it's almost as if there's a truth about marriage, as a truth, or not necessarily all marriages by any means, but there's a truth about relationship that people cannot speak about publicly. They cannot speak about in ways that it makes sense to a lot of women. They can only speak about it in extreme terms, which many women will not identify with. But we know because we've been through it, so we don't have to discuss that. We already know, we share that, so we can just forget about that and just get on with what's important and help people who. And we don't have to. They don't have to explain anything because we already have that shared experience. Mm. And I think the fact that I was helped, I know without a shadow of doubt, without the support worker, no matter what degree you've got, no matter which job you had beforehand, makes no difference. Without a support worker, there's no way I could have navigated all the agencies, the legal issues, financial issues in the state I was in. There's no way. And I just wanted to give something back. But I think also it helps me understand other people, you know, people, other people I've met in supported housing. You've got people who have mental health illnesses. You've got people who've come out of ex-offenders. They're people who I would have met on a personal one-to-one basis. You've got substance misuse, alcohol misuse, and I'm not. You've got teenage pregnancies, older people. You suddenly have a common ground, a very real common ground, because they're all in supported housing. Mm. And you realise what their lives are like, and you realise that no one really, at the end of the day, speaks for them.
Yeah. You agree?
Yeah, and also, you know, more importantly, let's not forget the children, because we're fleeing the domestic violence and we're taking the children along with us. Some of them are old enough to say, yes, please, let's do it, like... My ones were, they were grateful that we left the home. We can now hug freely, sit down and talk freely. But there are some children who are not prepared or not aware this is what's going to happen to their lives. So you're moving them away from their support network. You then have to access the housing, the schools. They have to make friends. But why do they tell their friends or new schoolmates, I had to leave my home because of... They don't want to do that. They only feel comfortable discussing it with other children their age or... bit older, who have been through it and can understand it. Because the one thing that's become clear to me is that yes, we've become friends as well as colleagues because of the domestic violence. However, we none of us judge one another. We accept one another for who we are and everything we've been through. Mm. We don't have to ask questions.
So in terms of peer support, how does it work?
The peer support group that is held at by Westside Support Services at Bishop Crichton House in Fulham from the 12th of February every 4 weeks for the whole year. They invite anyone who has experienced, is experiencing, would like to know more about. Because some people come and they may not want to disclose that they're going through it, which is fine. Anyone who wants to come is free to come in with their children or without. And it's just 2 hours and you have access to legal help, free legal advice. You have therapies, everything, lots of different things are happening in those 2 hours, which means that you can either find out more, get some help or legal advice that you wouldn't, in a very relaxed atmosphere. I mean, you have things like reflexology and other stuff going on, but I mean, it's very, very relaxed atmosphere. And through that way, you can get people to engage and see what their options are. A lot of the time, it's because we don't know. We haven't got the knowledge. I mean, I actually left my husband twice. The first time was 2001 when my son was one. And I went to the council then and I told him what was going on. And they gave me a place to move to, and it was in Leytonstone. It was a horrible place, far away from anybody, but I didn't care. I was so grateful. But then I got a letter a couple of weeks later, and I was told that my case wasn't strong enough. I did not know that I could appeal that. Mm-hmm. If I'd gone to a peer support group, I'd have known that. I didn't know. So I went back for another 6 years of absolute, and it was worse. It was mm-hmm. It was 10 times worse. So it's knowledge.
So what does it mean that your case isn't strong enough?
I didn't even have anyone to ask because there was no. I didn't know what it meant.
But somebody decided you weren't being abused enough.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know, funny, it's true. You're not being abused enough, or your case isn't strong enough. But this today and this week, I think there's a ruling that even shouting, I mean, I know a lot of people think it's over the top. They think shouting at somebody is classed as abuse. But I think if you only knew the stories, and I know some of the stories even around this table here haven't been told, but if you only knew what people do within the privacy of their own homes to their children or to their spouses, and it goes both ways, by the way, not just women get abused, men.
And I acknowledge that.
Yeah, it goes both ways. You'd understand why some of these rulings that shouting at someone incessantly can be classed as abuse. Even whispering. I can tell you whispering into children's ears and things that you wouldn't possibly say. And another thing is that it's always the sort of I always hear this thing is he didn't strike me as that kind of chap, or he didn't strike me. I mean, there's a picture in people's minds or a general thing that they could identify an abuser, but you can't. They come in all shapes and sizes, all forms. You can't. It's not just one photo fit.
Do you think? And this is a question to anyone who'd like to answer it, as opposed to being directed to one of you. If women are sufficiently supported, and I say women because this is a show with women, and you know we could do another show with men, but for the sake of this argument, then we keep it to women. Do you think women are sufficiently supported?
I can only speak from my personal experience. Yes, I was. I had 100% support, but at the end of the day, the buck does stop with the woman. If she is going to leave because of domestic violence, she needs to feel comfortable in asking for help, taking the help, but also being honest. By the time I reached a woman's refuge, I was beyond caring how or who or what people thought of me. It was about being honest, getting a safe home for myself and my children, and, you know, just being comfortable to be me without the threat of violence or the shouting, because for me, the shouting was by far the worst.
Women being adequately supported, that's a huge question. I think generally, domestic violence apart, no, women are not adequately supported in this society, simply because the expectation of how children can be and the potential and how what children are expected to become, their potential, is really down at the end of the day to the carer. And that's mainly women, not always, mainly women. And the expectation is so high that a woman sacrifices nearly everything. And I'm sure I stand to be corrected, but I do feel from my experience and seeing other women that there's a lot is expected of women when it comes to raising children, whether you work or you don't work. And I don't think it's fully appreciated what goes into that rearing of children. I don't think it's fully appreciated, and I think sometimes it's equated with money, equated with a job, you know. And I think that is the foundational problem. I can't quite articulate it completely, but I think it's very wrong and inadequate to equate ordinary employment with raising a child. And I think they do that somehow. It's like an outcome, or it's like a money thing, and it takes a lot more than finances. It takes the lifeblood or the sacrifice of one parent to raise a child adequately. And for example, I don't know how, there's so many things that go through my mind when you say this. This is domestic violence apart. So women are under a lot of pressure already, and we know that. I think one of the things this whole issue brought up for me about marriage and women and their responsibilities is that the child benefit allowance that was cut, I think they failed to understand that a significant amount of women depend completely on child benefit as their sole source of income. Now, people will not ever admit that because it's too shameful. But there are so many marriages where economics is not imbalanced, that the women and the children, their sole source of income, unless they ask for money, is child benefit. I was one of those. I'll admit it to you, but many people will not admit it. There were times when I was pregnant, I had one young child, younger than two. I'd have to ask for money for different things and phone him at work and say, please, this is a solicitor. Could I have some money for this? Could I please have some money for some food? Oh, I left money on the shelf, top shelf, bookshelf, £5. you know, things like that. So you have to search for money in the house after thinking you had nothing. And then if you ask for money in front of, I used to ask him for money for something before he left for work, and maybe I get £20 thrown on the floor. That was a good day. So I'm speaking from experience, and I'm a well-educated woman. I had a good job, so it makes nothing to do with that.
No, of course not.
So as for women being adequately supported, I think in other cultures, even Africa where I come from, I know there are huge shortfalls, and believe me, that's why I'm here. A lot of things that don't work. But one thing they do have is support when it comes to children. So they say it takes a whole a village to raise a child.
London's a big village. But to get back to the question of support and how you felt supported by other women, the experience of going through the supporting housing and in terms of hostel support, I know that they were dreadful experiences. Yeah. But you have talked about, as a group, about the camaraderie that we mentioned earlier in terms of women looking after women, other women, that it was very important.
Yeah. I found the housing section frightening. Having owned my own home, left that. Now you're going off to the council to plead homelessness on the grounds of domestic violence. A lot of women will tell you they worry about whether or not their stories are going to be believed. Where are they going to end up? What conditions? It was the most frightening experience. And I was actually told by a homeless housing officer that my domestic violence wasn't that extreme and that I should actually return back to my husband, to the home, simply because by the time my name entered the homeless housing list and I was bidding, it would take me years to get a property, and by then my youngest is 10, would have grown up and left home, so I'd only be entitled to a one-bedroom property. I was amazed, because I'm actually fleeing domestic violence. Like I said, my husband never had the chance to hit me because my three older children stood in the way, but once they had moved on and got on with their lives, where would I have been if I had returned back to that home? It wasn't nice. The funding, like I said, I had the most fantastic support, but even that is a milestone. If you don't understand the benefit system, you are going to fall flat on your face. So yeah, it's a scary road to walk.
So you three then, in terms of peer consulting and peer support, this is an initiative that was set up through New Labour. Am I right in thinking?
I believe that peer consulting, service use involvement, which we're all part of, whether you're aware of it or not, because peer support mentoring is the same thing. It's service user involvement. People who've been through the services in one shape or another, then helping to run those services or inform those services or mould the policies and the shape the services come in. I believe that was a New Labour initiative, and it's a requirement. The services I speak for are supporting people. They have a government presence in each borough of the land, and they have a huge budget. Now, one of the prerequisites is that they involve their service users for funding. They have the money, but they will get providers of services. Does that make any sense? I don't want to talk all that jargon. They do, but I've become a bit like that. But
that's okay. We like the jargon.
Okay. Well, they have to justify that they can only get funding if they tick certain boxes, as we all know. But the service user involvement decrees that service users, people who use their services, must be involved in the management, in the reviewing of the services, must be consulted, and everything like that. They must sit at their board meetings, to strategy meetings. There should be service user representation, and the outcome, which is what the government looks at, value for money, and all this. You always hear value for money. The outcome must be related to service user satisfaction. If the service user, like us, that's us guys, if we're not happy, if something is wrong with the service, then we should say so, and it should go back to supporting people, and that should affect the funding of the provider, and that should also inform the next provider as to, you know, when they're tendering, who can come in. We have to have a say. We have a say as to who will provide the refuge. We should have a say in who will provide the support worker, floating support. We have a say as to who provides the housing, who's given the money for that. Because if they're not making us happy, they're not doing a good job. And I think that needs to be further developed, because the people who are peer consultants, who go around on foot and ask each service user like ourselves, are you happy? What's the housing like? They have a standard form.
Right.
Basically, don't get paid.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, and there are two things that I wanted to ask about in terms of that. One is the idea of David Cameron's Big Society, which I'm a little obsessed by, but and also how that works and how that could in some way benefit you, because all this work that you're doing, this great work you're doing for free, and the second thing was in terms of accountability and supporting others. How do you feel? Because it's quite some time now since you all left your domestic situations.
Yeah.
So how do you feel? I mean, you're meeting women who are coming out of situations now all the time. How do you feel the situation has changed? Has it changed to benefit women? Are you still frustrated by some of the things that you went through, and you can see women going through the same thing? Or do you feel that women are more supported now? How would you feel about that, Angie?
At the moment, I'm still a service user.
Right.
So I'm still within the system. And it's just now I'm being supported. In the past, I haven't been. So right now, because I have a good support worker.
Right.
And I seem to be getting the right help and right advice and be put into right direction, basically. But in the past, I haven't felt that I had the right support. So I don't know. I haven't started the peer support. So we are still new to. I'm new to this, right. Basically. As I said, I'm still a service user.
Well, service. Sorry, the question. Okay, I think it has improved, but it's very slow. The improvement is extremely slow, and it's very patchy. Depends, you know, it's like this postcode lottery.
Right.
Depends where you live, depends which borough you're in. Different boroughs. Can I say my favourite? Oh, no, I won't say my favourite. Hostels, shared housing, supported housing. There's like, 1 to 10. Everyone knows, young people know which hostels are the best in London. There's a whole thing. Young people's hostels, young people's homes. They all know which one's the best one, which one's the worst.
Hmm.
It's like a, what's that Rue thing, you know, the culinary style, 4-star, 2-star, everyone knows. But it's very patchy. It's it depends on the borough, and but it has improved. And I think the reason it has improved is that you have service user involvement. The stronger your service user involvement is, the stronger the better the service will be for service users.
Mm.
Simple as that. They're the clients. If they're happy, then they should be funding. If they're not happy, then that provider should be removed and someone else, a better service provided. And I think what people fail to, you know, in this cutting the public sector, the bureaucracy or whatever, but the money basically, I'm just hoping it doesn't involve cutting, well, it won't involve cutting service users, because they're volunteers who work for nothing. But I do think if this big society thing is going to work, you're going to have to at some point involve service user representatives, because they're the only ones who will tell you, who can find out the truth about what's actually going on at the grassroots.
Mm.
No one else can tell you, because they're all busy ticking boxes and being paid for it.
Absolutely.
We're not paid, but we can stand and say, yeah, well, I can give you names and, you know, what they like. They're people, they're humans, and we can tell you whether they're happy or not, what's going on, and how to get things working. If you don't ask people who've been through, you know, they will say, this doesn't work, that doesn't work, you know, people are unemployed. But you don't ever stop to ask people who they say are unemployed what their experiences are. The only image of the unemployed that we get is someone who's never worked ever, you know, or some very high-powered person who's just lost their job because of the recession. There's a whole range of people, and you never ever hear directly from them. Why? And that's why I believe service users come in very handy, because they are trained, they've been through the system, and they know what works, what doesn't work. So if they are going to use this big society, what's it called, the big David Cameron's Big Society, there is no big society unless you involve service user representation. And I say Kensington and Chelsea, funnily enough, is actually one of the boroughs who are very, very strong on their service user involvement peer consultants, because they have a commissioner that actually walks the streets. He goes from, you know, he knows people by name.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think he's very, he's like a hero that no one ever, he's also got a disability, but, you know, He's brilliant. Other boroughs, commissioners are never seen. They're in the town hall. They're very lovely people. They have their homes and, you know, they have a job to do. But this particular commissioner who's involved in West London peer consultants, he goes from to people's homes if he has to. He makes sure they're not chucked out of their homes. He makes sure he goes to different services. He knows everyone. And he walks the streets from morning till evening. And that's and he gets paid. But, I mean, so do others who sit down and do nothing. So there are different ways of involving people. And the only way you're going to get this big society thing moving, in my opinion, is if you get people who've been through the system, who are articulate and who can speak up for and not being paid for it.
But then how can you afford to do it? You've got kids to raise.
Mm-hmm. I can't not do it.
No.
I find it very hard to go back to, I'm going in bit by bit to, back into reporting, back into voiceovers, commentaries, which is my background before, media work, but I refuse to leave all this behind because it would be totally empty without it. It's something I feel, because I know that there's no way I could survive, and I know that it's, you know, it just needs to be done. Otherwise, we'll always be in the same place.
Mm. You know, and that's incredible, and because you were, you know, you held down a great job as a, you know, legal.
Yeah, and I'm hoping not too long distant in the future that I will be returning to that. That's why I'm quite happy to be a peer support group mentor, because luckily for me, these meetings do take place on a Saturday, so you know you can put a couple of hours away shopping, be done later or the day before or the night before, and bring your kids along. Get to meet us, we get to meet you, hold your hand, we can cry and laugh together, play with the children, you know, and then you get a chance to offload. But I think what we can bring to this as well is our experience.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to disbelieve you, we don't have to question you, you just get a chance to speak.
So then I'm clear about how it works. You then can help women through the system, where to take their first steps, or how to take their first steps.
Yeah.
Another thing Marcy is not Marcy is not saying is that she often is called upon by people in the community, because in the community people get to know who can help,
right,
and who will do it on the spot there and then and act, not just speak. And she goes into schools and things on behalf of mothers or parents. She sort of intercedes, is an intermediary and advocate, if you like, because of her legal background, and gets things done very, very quickly.
Efficiently.
Yeah. Whether she's got the badge or not. And another thing is she works on people's perceptions, because she'll go into a situation with a parent, for example, into a school, and their immediate perception is she's not somebody professional.
Mm-hmm.
She uses the preconceived stereotype. You know, they look at her, take one look, oh, nothing to worry about there, that kind of attitude. And she lets everyone have their say.
Right.
And then she comes in with the legal, but with the precision of a surgeon, I must tell you. And it's very, very effective and quite amazing to watch. I must say it, because she hasn't said it herself. I kept telling her to say it, but she, you know.
She's very lucky to have you to say it.
Yeah, well, my motto in life is give a man enough rope to hang himself, beat a man, beat a woman. You take their information and you beat them with it. If they're going to force you into a situation you're not comfortable with, to do with yourself, to do with your child, know your rights. If you're not aware of them, I will quite happily tell you, and I will hold your hand and inform that person we do know our rights. Because ultimately, whatever decision is going to be made regarding yourself, your child, your home, you have a say in that. You now have freedom of speech. You dictate your life and your home, your family. Don't let somebody else do it for you.
Mm-hmm.
You can do it yourself.
There must be something about confidence. I mean, we talked earlier about how, you know, the situation at home meant that you lost your jobs. And you've talked about not feeling so wonderful by the end of the experience or going through the experience. And I don't say that glibly. I'm just trying to find the right words. I can't describe how your situations might have been or how intolerable they were. But in terms of regaining confidence and getting your life back to something like it was like before, or even better than it was before, what's that like?
Empowering. I mean, yeah, we've gone down the rocky road, and myself and my colleague here, Toyin, we've come through it. And we're quite happy now that we've got Angie. So, you know, as well as being one of our colleagues, she's now become one of our friends, so whatever support she will need for her and her family, we can do that because we're further along. So, yeah, we're feeling empowered. But more importantly, like I said, we've been down that road, so we can guide the woman, the family, to get them through the other end.
And it does take, I do think it takes somebody who has the legal knowledge or some other kind of knowledge, but actually having been through the system. And I do always say, because I do the service user, editor of a service user newsletter, that you need to make your experience count. It doesn't matter whether you've been to, whether you've finished school or not. Well, it does matter, but I mean, that isn't the most crucial thing. Make your experience count. I think people's experiences are very, very, are more than useful. They can use that to help other people. And I think the thing I see Marcia and other peer consultants do, people who have the funds, people who have money, have access to in the wider community. They have access to help. They can pay for the best help, the most effective help in the shortest amount of time, space of time, because people pay by the hour at that, in that, at that level. But I think at this, at the level of when it comes to education, when it comes to health, when it comes to social services, you need somebody who's going to, who knows the system perfectly, knows exactly what to say, how to say it, what legal term needs to be used, so that the people, the establishment hears you. Because they only hear certain key words. And you need to be able to say those key words in a short space of time to get the desired result. And I think over time, we sort of boil down which ones you need for which situation. And so that's how we can help others. Support workers do the same thing, but they have an official badge. And they've been doing it. They're very, very experienced. A good one is very, very experienced, and they can do the nuances and everything. But we have just learned, just by going through the situation, which keywords are needed, which legal terms are needed, and just say those things and leave it at that. Because at the very beginning, I was just an emotional mess. I'd right. say everything, talk too much, cry. That doesn't work.
I found out also the language you mentioned. I didn't have that voice. I didn't have that language. I didn't have the badge. Whereas my support worker could talk for me, and through her badge, I have managed to get where I am now. And that has been really life-changing for me.
Yeah. And another thing that's improved is that, at least in Hammersmith and Fulham, is that there's one gateway, there's one place you go to for all the services. So therefore, this is how it's meant to work anyway. Therefore, you don't keep repeating your story over and over again, having to tell a different official each time, and then losing bits of the story along the way, and being losing dignity every time you mention the story again and again, and having to deal with different responses, whether it's ranging from unbelief to you know, someone being very dismissive. I mean, at each time, so you're meant to go to one place, one gateway, and it's meant to deal with everything, all your needs.
And what of the other side of this? Is there any accountability for the people who caused this abuse?
Well, that's a big question.
Esther,
Are you talking about the perpetrator?
Yeah.
Well, depending on the level of abuse, they can be charged. They can go to court. They can end up being jailed. They can end up being out on bail and monitored. They can end up being forced by the legal profession to go to a contact centre to meet with their children, or they can lose contact altogether with their children. But you will find that the majority of men who do put women through this don't actually suffer once the woman has gone with the children. They will just find another person. And I'm not going to... Some people could say they'll find another victim. I don't agree with that. I was never a victim. I was just unfortunate to meet what I thought was the right person, and who showed me this face, but once I married him, showed me the true face. So, you know, we're none of us victims, but you go out there and they force us to become this person that they want, which is submissive, toeing the line, handing over everything, agreeing to everything they say. So you find that a lot of these guys tend to go on and repeat this pattern of behaviour with the next in the next relationship, unfortunately.
They do. There is, I know Hestia is one group. They manage a lot of services. Domestic violence supported housing is one of them. And they provide training or workshops for perpetrators. They do that. I don't think every provider does that. I'm not sure how effective they are, but at least they run them. I think it's, sorry if you hang on, I think it's CAFCAS. The children, and if CAFCAS, it's just the Children and Family Courts Advisory Support Service, if they're involved and if social services are involved in a particular case, then generally the perpetrator will have to go through some kind of training or retraining or workshop or therapy or something like that. As I say, I don't know how effective it is.
And apart from the practical support that you have received, have you also had some sort of counselling to help with the emotional side of things?
Well,
and psychological side of things.
I'm just been requesting that because I realise I reached a point in my life that I need to have that counselling. For me, in my case, my abuser, my husband, died, left me with children who witness all that. And I have been receiving it from my son who grew up in that environment. And he's my child, so that is another difficulty for me to deal with. And in order to get help for him, I'm going through the emotional side of it, and I really, really need to revisit what I have experienced in order to get over all that emotional side of it to be able to help my son.
And you believe your son is following a similar pattern to his father?
Yes. I mean, I'm trying to get him help, but I have spent summer time going through the whole process of being abused by him physically, and hospitals and GPs and courts and police and all that process. And although I'm getting lots of help for him to not to follow that pattern of behavior, but it's affecting me by taking me 15 years back.
Right.
And it's right now I have been seeking to deal with the psychological side of it. So I'm in that process at the moment.
When you go into any kind of supported housing, you have a key worker or a support worker, and you have a plan, you have an action plan, and they assess your needs to see exactly what the needs are. It could be psychological, could be medical, whatever, and they help you access those services and link you up with that so that you should be getting these things. These are part of the things you're meant to be getting as soon as you arrive, basically, if you need them, or when as the need arises. But I think this therapy thing, it's all well and good to give us all therapy, but I think in society generally, this whole issue of the sports presenter who was speaking about women,
the lineswoman,
mic, and it was actually a private thing. I think the thing is, there's this debate about what's bantering, what is acceptable in public and what's acceptable at home. There seems to be, or in private rather, there seems to be a discrepancy. And I think generally, have you ever defined what's acceptable behind closed doors? What is it that is acceptable? And so maybe we all need some kind of therapy one way or other, because what is acceptable? No one can define it. No one can limit anybody else, because it would be wrong. However, we need to actually see what actually is acceptable.
And what people are really thinking.
Yeah.
And Toyn's referring to the recent row over the two Sky sports presenters who have recently either lost or given up their posts because of the sexist comments they made about the female lines. Lineswoman, female lineswoman. just to stamp the point. But that brings me on to a question I have about when you and I first talked about this, Toyn. We talked. You mentioned, and one of the first things you said in that room of women at the South Bank Centre when I first met you, you talked about having a fall from grace.
Yeah.
And I thought that it was a wonderful title for today's show, but we decided that perhaps not. But, and of course, at the time, it's a lovely phrase, but that fall from grace, that socially one has taken a knock. Do you think, and of course, talking about domestic violence, I mean, we've also changed the names of two of our guests today, and for reasons you don't want to be identified, which are
quite adequate reasons and important reasons, but it's somehow it's still a taboo. It's still there's a stigma attached. I don't know because I don't come from within the experiences that you've had or the group of.
Well, Fall from Grace for me first of all speaks of a religious thing, because when you first say fall from grace, it means you've lost that power, that spiritual holiness or whatever. But actually, for me, it was actually the reverse. This actually, it was like saving grace. This actually made me open my eyes about certain things. It brought me to the truth of certain things. And it was grace that saved me. I mean, it sounds really corny, but actually got me this far. But the fall from grace, yeah, there's this whole attitude, you're not meant to speak about these things. And it's women who have been through this, either non-desirable or tarnished goods or whatever, then there must be quite a few women out, you know, that are tarnished. Simple as that. Because so many women, I've understood now that most women have gone through some kind of abuse in abusive relationship in their lives, whether they realize it or they don't realize it. It's just that it's acceptable because it hasn't really harmed or changed their path, if you like. But yes, there is this fall from grace. I mean, I was working, I had my own flat, I was a freelance, worked a lot of BBC, whatever, you know. When it comes to success in society's terms, you know, it was not bad. I was working on it, but right. You know, it was work in progress. I wasn't doing badly at all. Then suddenly you fall from, you're not on the radar anymore. You suddenly silence. And whenever you see that about a woman, suddenly there's silence and you can't see it. You have to ask. But people don't ask, really, because you just don't do it. You don't ask. It's a bit like being permanently pregnant. You know, if you're an employee, a woman, and you know, it's like you're permanently pregnant, then that means that's the end. No one says anything. Silence.
I was just thinking the same thing.
It's over. Literally, it's over. And so anything that falls into that category is naturally a fall of some kind. And I suppose women have always been involved with the fall. From the very beginning, we were involved in the fall and we will always be condemned for fall. But the truth is that I think really it was probably, I'm saying this now, I'm hoping next year I won't regret it, but probably the making of me. Because suddenly there's a truth that I can speak about, that I've been through, that I can articulate. And I've met other people who also have truths that need to be articulated. And I think the time is now that these things need to be aired in public. And not just domestic violence, not domestic violence alone, but this big society thing. I think it's about time that people who are never heard, who are the silence, who have all fallen from grace, whether in other shape, whether it's mental illness, whatever it is, I think it's about time that they were heard. After all, they're part of the big society.
Would you agree, Matthew?
I've just been sitting here listening to Toyin and all manner of things are going through my head. Fall from grace, I remember when I actually did take the words of my children and made the decision, yes, I'm going to leave this home. And to be perfectly honest with you, I had this feeling of dread going from my home that I owned with my husband into social housing and having been made redundant and what the hell am I going to do for money now and having to line up and sign on. It put the fear of God into me. But I'm going to be honest with you, I sit before you, a woman who's living in social housing, who has lost her home, who is signing on, looking for a job, so here you go, with a great big dirty smile on my face because the weight's been lifted off my shoulder. And I don't concentrate on what I used to have. I now concentrate on what I'm going to have.
Great.
Mm-hmm. And of course, Angie's still going through the process, so.
Yes, but I'm looking forward to it as well, like Marcy and the rest of them looking forward to it. At least I don't have that. Somehow something is released. That pressure is released. Although I didn't get him to become, you know, be accountable for what he did, but he died naturally. And I think that for me is a release. Although you get used to your abuser for whatever you lived for so long. You've been partner, you had kids together. Part of you is still attached to them, although they were not making you happy.
Right.
So I do miss him sometimes. But when I think of how my experience was with him, I'm thankful to God that I'm without him, basically.
Mm. And understandably so. We have a few minutes left. Are there any burning issues or comments that we'd like to round up on? And I know that there are a few numbers that you really felt was important to give out on air.
I wanted to give the West Side Support Services.
And West Side Support are based in?
In Mulliner House, Flander Road in Chiswick. And it's W41NN. And they are based with Shepherd's Bush Housing in Chiswick. We have email address and telephone number. Shall I give them?
Please do.
It's Westside, one word, .support@sbhg.co.uk. And the telephone number is 0208-996-8810. I also want to give the first session of our peer support group, which is on the February 12th, and that would be what, 10?
That's going to be starting at 11 a.m. until 1 p.m. and yeah. will be held at Bishop Crichton House, which is in Fulham. One of there's two things I wanted to highlight. For women out there who are not sure whether or not you're going through domestic violence, you can always access the Refuge organisation's website, www.refuge.org.uk. It also gives you information on how to delete the cookie if you don't want to be found out on that website. The other thing is you can always ring them on 0808 200 247 and run your ideas or anything you're experiencing you're not sure of or how to get into a woman's refuge.
And if all else, if you forget anything else, just remember, just dial 999. That's what I did. And you don't have to bring charges. They can do that for you too. So it's much easier now.
So we're going to wrap up. We're going to say an enormous thank you. I know that today's show was quite an emotional one, but and I'm hoping inspiring for others listening. And one of the things that really struck me when I met you was that you talked about your desire to, if in any way, if you could help other people. And I think that's just incredible. And I think it's wonderful work that you're doing. And thank you for being on today's show.
Thank you.